It's been said that if you do what you've always done, you're going to get what you've always got. Here's a chance to learn new ways to be with people and to be with yourself as well. Tune into The Positive Mind Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 1 p.m. on WBAI 99.5. It's knowledge from the heart, my friends.
Welcome to The Positive Mind. I'm Dr. Bernard Starr. Just call me Dr. Bernie or just plain Bernie. And I'm sitting in today for Armand DeMille. And we have an exciting show planned for today. So who is Bernie Starr, you may be asking? Of course, some of you have heard me before with Armand. Armand and I go way back. Basically, I'm a psychologist. I practiced and explored a number of therapies, methods over the years. Armand and I once started a therapy institute together, actually. I wrote a few books. I taught at a university. I write a weekly column, Spiritual Psychology, for United Press International. And bingo, I'm here on The Positive Mind on WBAI 99.5 FM. And I'm thrilled to be here, and particularly on this show, on Armand's Positive Mind. And isn't that a great title for a show, The Positive Mind? It already, just the mere mention of it, puts you into a positive mood. And I'm really thrilled to be here today. And I think my guest today is thrilled as well. And that's my old friend, Dr. Henry Kellerman. Welcome to The Positive Mind.
Thanks,
BAI.
Thanks,
Henry.
Nice to be here.
It's great to have you here. I think I got to get a show to see you. You're so busy all the time.
Right.
And let me just tell a few things about you, Henry. I don't want to list everything and inflate your ego too much today. But Henry, Dr. Henry Kellerman, is really a Renaissance man, a jack of all trades, in a sense. You're basically a psychologist and psychoanalyst, and he's held faculty positions at universities and at hospitals, and he's written a lot of books, and we're going to be talking about one of them today, or at least the idea in one of his books. But, you know, Henry, what really impresses me about you and your work and your writings is the tremendous range, the breadth of the subjects that you have explored and that you've written about. For example, your works include emotions and personality, dreams and nightmares, love and hate, animal behavior with dolphins. Did you actually swim with dolphins?
Of course.
Amazing.
Sure.
And you did some work with chimpanzees and baboons, studied the psychology of sleep disorders, and also have explored group psychotherapy.
Well, I published a book on sleep disorders.
You're all over the lot, right. Henry. And today we're going to be talking about one of your books, your most recent one, Four Steps to a Peace of Mind. And that, of course, is a very exciting idea. It's not 12 steps. It's not 9 steps. It's not 8 steps. I mean, 4 steps. That I could already hear people pulling their chairs closer to the radio to hear just four steps to peace of mind. Now, the thing that intrigues me about this book is that you are basically and trained as a psychoanalyst.
Right.
Okay, and that raises a number of questions about what you have in this book, because the book is about, and I remember your original title, or you have a professional, this is for the general public, but you have a professional version of it, and I believe it was called something like The Psychoanalysis of Symptoms.
Well, that was another book I published for the professional audience, but this book originally was called something like Curing Psychological Symptoms.
Right, but from a psychoanalytic perspective, perspective.
Yeah.
And we think of psychoanalysts as not dealing with things directly. As a matter of fact, let me just start with a little joke kind of about psychoanalysis, which is sort of a setup of getting into some of these ideas. Just imagine these two very stiff British men sitting in a drawing room, And one of them is reading a report in the London Times, and he says, have a straw. He says, here's a report on when students have sex at the University of Minnesota, and that apparently 40% have sex in the afternoon, 30% in the early evening, 29% after the 11 o'clock news, and 1% during lectures on Aristotle. And he said, that's astonishing. It's amazing. It's mind-boggling. I didn't know that they still teach Aristotle at the University of Minnesota. Uh-huh. Now, okay, what's the relevance to your work in psychoanalysis? I didn't know that people are still doing psychoanalysis.
Psychoanalysis is very much alive and kicking. There are many institutes around that teach psychoanalysis all over the country, all over the world.
Really?
And of course, it's the paradigm, it's the approach that humanities programs and universities use in English courses and to understand novels and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an intellectual discipline, but I find that fewer and fewer people actually practice what we would call classical psychoanalysis.
Well, classical psychoanalysis has a lot to be desired, in my opinion, but in the age of the quick fix, psychoanalysis receded a bit because it's not a quick fix.
Well, yes, and it has a specific method, and that leads me to my
right.
Next story.
Okay.
That is a kind of humorous characterization of psychoanalysis, and we'll talk about that. Here, this woman comes in to see her psychoanalyst, and she says to the let me preface this by saying this is kind of like a joke within a story, but this happens to be a true story. It was told to me by an editor friend of mine who was on his way to a meeting of the American Psychiatric Association in Chicago. And when the stewardess on the plane realized that the plane was filled with psychoanalysts and shrinks, she decided to hold a psychoanalyst shrink joke contest.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm going to tell you, this is the winner of the contest. That a woman arrives to see you for her appointment with her analyst, and she says to him, you know, I've been in analysis with you for 7 years. You haven't said anything to me. You know, analysts supposedly don't say very much. I'm not getting any better. In fact, I think I'm getting worse, and you really haven't told me anything about it, haven't said anything, and I would like to terminate the analysis. You know, there's no response. And she says, well, say something. You know, I want to terminate the psychoanalysis. And finally, he looked at her and he said, no hablo inglés.
No. The better joke, Bernie, is about this guy that comes to see a shrink. And the psychoanalyst says, what are you here for? And the guy says, well, I'm having these terrible nightmares where animals, tigers and leopards, jumping under my bed, sliding under my bed at night, and I can't sleep. It's terrible. I have to get over this. And the shrink says, well, you know, I can help you with that because I understand nightmares. And let's make an appointment so you come back next week. And they say, okay. And the guy never shows up again. And 2 years later, he meets the guy on the street, and he says, whatever happened to you? And the guy says, well, you see, my brother-in-law is a carpenter, and he sawed off the legs of the bed, and that's the end of it.
Very, very cute.
Yeah.
So let's talk a bit about psychoanalysis, because in the story that I told, and I think that this is the popular view that people have, is that psychoanalysts don't say very much, and they're certainly what is called non-directive. Yet in your approach, you do something very direct. You say that you can cure symptoms in 4 steps and that people could use this actually to help themselves, to cure themselves. So let's just clarify a few things about psychoanalysis.
Right.
What exactly is psychoanalysis and psychoanalytic treatment?
Yeah. Well, you know, only one thing gets cured in psychoanalysis, and that's symptoms. Psychoanalysis cures nothing else but symptoms. As a matter of fact, no therapy cures anything. No talk therapy cures anything but symptoms. And the behavior therapists and so forth have a lot of trouble curing symptoms. But psychoanalysis can cure symptoms. That's the only thing we can cure. You can't cure life otherwise. So the best thing psychoanalysts do is they help people struggle better. The objective in the psychoanalytic endeavor is to help people struggle better, because people don't struggle very well at all. witness a 50% divorce rate.
Right. Okay. Yeah. But now I'm looking at what one psychoanalyst wrote about, you know, what it is. And there's a distinction between classical psychoanalysis and psychoanalytic therapy.
Right.
And, of course, we know that with classical analysis, it takes many years and it's very frequent visits. And, you know, almost nobody could do that today. So, you know, how is that incorporated? And what is that difference between classical and what probably most people do when they say, well, I do psychoanalytic therapy?
That's a tough question, Bernie. You know, it's a different kind of age now. And in classical psychoanalysis, if you were in 5 days a week, you couldn't do much else. If you were a student, you had to drop out of school because it took too much energy.
You really right, and who has the bucks to do that today?
Who has the bucks also? So it was streamlined and it was condensed for the better, so that psychoanalytic therapy can be done twice a week, and psychoanalytic-oriented therapy can even be done once a week.
Mm-hmm.
If people are very depressed, you don't do psychoanalytic therapy because you don't want to go into unraveling things. If someone's very depressed, you want to support them and reinforce things, not unravel things.
Okay, now, but what about this notion that analysts, at least this is the image that people have, that they don't really say very much, that you free associate, that you kind of discover things yourself, in contrast to what we're going to be discussing soon, your very directive book on four steps.
Well,
I mean, for example, here are some of the characterizations, according to this report and description of psychoanalytic therapy, that the analyst is neutral, that the method is free association, that essentially the change takes place through what is called transference,
right?
You know, where the person transfers all feelings of
significant
others
yes.
in their life,
yes.
their parents, siblings, etc., onto the analyst, and somehow that gets worked out that way through what's called the working through process.
Right.
So in that context, it would seem at least that that you've modified some of this to adapt to current conditions to be much more directive.
Well, only when you're working on symptoms. See, my book is all about symptoms. And when you work on symptoms, it's in the patient's best interest to eliminate the symptom as fast as possible. And so if there are four specific steps or four ways of understanding, different ways of understanding how to unravel the symptom, the best thing to do is to do it efficiently. So unraveling a symptom is an adjunct, an appendage to the psychoanalytic method, but it's not, strictly speaking, a psychoanalysis of the symptom. You unravel the symptom and eliminate, erase the symptom, and then if you want to do future work with respect to the patient's conflicts and problems, that's fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Give us some examples of the kinds of symptoms that you're dealing with that people come in with, because people are concerned with symptoms.
Yeah.
That's what they report when they come in to see a therapist.
Well, first of all, a symptom is some kind of experience you're having that has a grip on you. You experience it. It's involuntary. You can't change it. You can't talk the symptom out of itself. It's got you. You ain't got it.
Mm-hmm. Well, in that respect, what would you say to the behavior therapist? That's a very popular form of therapy,
right?
And many people go to behavior therapists specifically for that purpose. That the behavior therapists make no bones about it, that they deal directly with symptoms and treating symptoms, rather than getting into what we call underlying dynamics.
Well, we'd have to understand what they mean by a symptom. When I'm talking about a symptom, it's something like, let's say, a phobia or an intrusive thought, a thought that comes into your head and you can't shake it, an obsessive compulsive thing.
Right.
Kind of
okay, and we'll get into some of those specific
cases.
But for the moment, I'm just trying to see, and for our listeners to understand, where this approach kind of fits in compared to other approaches, because a lot of people listening
right.
and have gone to
so let me give you
therapists
some
of
let me
a
give
whole
some,
range.
Yeah, let me give you some principles. You see, I would say that where there is a symptom, not only will there be underlying anger, there must be underlying anger. And so if you're simply doing behavior therapy and you don't get to the underlying anger, you cannot cure the symptom.
Right. Well, exactly. And that's the point that I was trying to get to,
right.
that the behaviorists deal direct with changing the
right.
symptom, whereas in psychoanalysis, which is called sometimes dynamic therapy, means you get into underlying causes.
Right.
So that, let's say somebody comes in to see a therapist of any ilk and says, I'm frightened of snakes, let's say, and I, want to deal with that issue. So the behavior therapist might deal directly with it. They do a whole variety of things like exposing the person in a graded kind of way to first, let's say, pictures of snakes, and then it may get more intensive where at some point you view, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, okay. But in the dynamic approach, you might say, well, what does the snake represent? And you may go into that, whether it be anger.
I wouldn't ask what the snake represents. I would say, I would assume from the beginning that if the person's afraid of something, they're really angry at someone and they're unconscious of that. It's repressed. They don't know they're angry. And the other principle is, or the axiom is, the self-evident truth is, where there is underlying anger toward a specific person, and it's unconscious, not only will there be a symptom, there must be a symptom.
Well, isn't
now,
there room,
in
Henry?
In behavior therapy, if the behavior therapist cures the symptom, I would say it's only because inadvertently the anger was touched upon and surfaced, and that cured the symptom. And nothing else cured the symptom, just that. How about that?
Okay, so, well, let's go into your whole approach to this, because it's very intriguing and, and very inviting in a way.
Right.
I mean, because the fact is, if there are four steps to the peace of mind, meaning dealing directly with your symptoms, that's great news. It's very welcome. And
By the way, the four steps to peace of mind was the publisher's title. And I thought that the publisher knows as much or a bit more about titles than I do, and I didn't care very much. But when people ask me, why do you call it the four steps, what's the title of your recent book? And I said the four steps to peace of mind. The first question everybody would ask me was, what are the four steps?
Well, of course,
yes.
Because that's the big hook.
Right.
So the publishers do know something.
They do know something.
But the fact is that in the book you do have four points
that
you call the points of the symptom code.
Right.
So let's go over that, okay. Because
it
is very inviting. So the first one, you said you have a wish.
Yes, we are all wish-soaked creatures. All of us are wish-soaked creatures. We're always wishing for things. Now, when a wish is gratified, when you get your wish, you feel empowered. You feel good and empowered. When you get your wish blocked or thwarted, you feel disempowered or helpless. The psychological hardcore principle to disempowerment or helplessness is, where there is helplessness, there will always be rage or anger.
Okay, but that's your next step. But
yes.
Initially, you're saying that underlying a symptom, there's always some wish
that's been blocked.
That is blocked
yes.
and thwarted.
That's right. That's step number one.
Okay, could you give an example of that, to clarify that?
Well, a person runs for a bus, let's say, and packages and wants to catch the bus, and catches the bus, but the bus pulls away. Give you a very, it's a very, simple example.
And what is the wish there?
The wish is to catch the bus. The person's going to be angry. I've heard people at bus stops curse under their breath when they miss the bus. Because they're happy? No. Because they're sad? No. Because they're angry. When the wish is blocked, you're always angry.
Right, but that doesn't necessarily lead to a symptom.
No. The anger, you have to not realize that you're angry. And frequently what happens is that you're angry at a person who has who's an authority over you, the person that you can't be, your boss. You can't be angry at the person. And instantly, in a split second, the anger is repressed. You don't know it's there. You might feel something is bothering you. You might feel what we call stress. You might feel that you're unhappy about something, but you won't quite put your finger on the fact that you're angry at that particular person. So that gets repressed. And when that gets repressed, not only will there be a symptom, there must be a symptom.
Well, but is there any way of cutting this off at that stage? Is there a way of...
Yeah, the little genie comes out of the bottle and says, you're angry right now. Come on, you're angry at this guy right now. And then, okay, if there's a genie, we could do it that way, but there's no genie.
Well, that's very interesting, because isn't it true that some people do have genies inside them?
Well,
that we know that there are a lot of people who are what we call resilient.
Or insightful.
Or insightful.
Introspective.
Okay.
Those people who can catch the anger, before it gets repressed and realize
that. Right. So this may be the point at which you want to intervene and maybe try to cut it off at the pass to short-circuit it.
If the shrink is standing at the bus stop with the person, okay. But the shrink is usually not at the bus stop, you see. And most people don't catch it. So everybody in this world at some time or another has symptoms.
So what we may need is an inner shrink.
That's right.
If we have an inner shrink, maybe we could cut this off at the pass.
That's what psychoanalysis does. It helps you become your inner shrink, which behavior therapy I don't think does, but psychoanalysis does.
Okay, well, let's move on to your next step. So
did I get you on that one or not?
You did.
Okay.
Okay, I'm with you
here.
And I think we're all with you I'm kind of playing
it.
The devil's
that
advocate
good,
here
good, yeah.
Because this is so inviting, and I'm sure everybody listening to this say, tell us more about this, because
okay, let's
if
say
there's
more
four
about
steps
it.
And we can embrace those and right. We could develop the inner the
right.
inner analyst.
So let me say one more thing about it. So when you repress the anger toward a particular person, that's the thing that needs to be surfaced into consciousness.
Okay, the two go hand in hand, is the wish and the anger, and they're really interrelated.
Now, Freud said, Freud didn't say everything that was brilliant, but many, many things were brilliant. And one thing was, he said, consciousness is curative. He was half right. It's true, consciousness is curative, provided that the content that's made conscious is the anger towards a particular person. Then consciousness is curative.
Okay, so that's step three now. So we start off with
the wish.
There's a wish or a thwarted wish.
Yes.
And that leads to anger.
That leads to disempowerment, a feeling of disempowerment.
Disempowerment. But
that leads to anger.
And that produces anger.
That gets
And
repressed.
Now you're saying in step three that anger is always very specific
toward a person.
Toward a person.
And if that person is not there, it's a circumstance, then the anger goes to the self. Why? Because the principle about emotion is that all emotion, in order to be realized as an emotion, must take a person. So if the person is not there toward whom the anger is directed, the anger still needs to take a person. And that person will be the self. So.
Well, let's go back to your example, though. Let's go back to the bus stop.
Right.
Okay. You're running for the bus. You missed the bus.
Right.
Your wish is that you make the bus. You don't. Okay,
you get angry.
And then you get angry. Now, who is the person?
I'll give you only one guess, Bernie.
One.
The bus driver.
The bus driver.
Of course. Of course. Who's controlling the bus?
Well, I wouldn't have thought that. I would have said.
Were you controlling the bus? You weren't there.
Well, but I might say, why didn't I leave 2 minutes earlier? I could have caught that bus.
Well, that's because you're a very rational person, but most of us.
But you just said that the anger is toward the self, and I think that in many cases.
In that case, the anger would not be toward the self. In that case, the anger would be a blaming kind of anger. In some cases, the anger is toward the self when there's no person available toward whom to attach the anger.
Right, but we'll always attach it to somebody,
yes,
is what you're
including
saying.
The self.
Okay, so we're developing here, you're saying that people develop a very neat package.
That's right.
Here. Okay, so we have three steps.
And by
so
the way,
far.
This is true of everyone in the world. There's no exception. Everyone in the world is subject to this experience.
That this is universal,
yes,
you're saying.
Even when there are no buses around.
Okay, so we have three steps here. There's the wish,
yes,
the anger,
right,
through the route that it takes, and then that anger is anger toward somebody specific.
That's right.
Okay,
it doesn't come out of
or somebody that, as you say, is opportunistic.
Right, it doesn't come out of the clear blue sky, and it's always about someone.
Okay, now we have step four though, because
yes.
we're not finished with
yes.
the package here, and step fourth is in dealing with the symptom is a need to do something about the wish. So that
right.
takes us back to number one.
To number one, right.
And what do you do about that? What is the thing to do?
The thing to do is to talk about it, to try to do something about it, to engage the process of the original wish, even if you don't get successful, at least being productive about it. You see, without doing the to-do, the symptom can still be erased. But if you do the to-do, it's more decisively erased. The symptom is more decisively erased. You see, so that's those are the four steps, and it applies to everybody on Earth. A little child sitting on a desert in Ethiopia, and you and me sitting right here.
Right. Okay, Henry. Of course, ultimately.
Give you an example.
Exactly. I mean, right. the proof is ultimately, as
all
they
right.
say, in the pudding. If it works,
all right.
it works, and we'll all be
let
thrilled.
Let me give you an example.
So let's go to some of
all
your
right.
cases.
Let me give you an example of a 35-year-old doctor.
Okay.
Okay. This is a true story. 35-year-old doctor works
this
in a
hospital. This is the patient you're talking about.
Yes, works in a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And he suddenly gets, he notices that he has an urge to gaze at dead bodies, at corpses. Very morbid. And so at the end of the day, when he's made his rounds and he's finished his work, he rushes over to the pathology department to gaze at various corpses in the process of dissection. And that gratifies him, and he feels better. His anxiety decreases, and his stress seems to disappear.
So this is a situation that most of us would consider kind of horrific and anxiety-provoking.
Right.
But for him, it
reduces the anxiety.
It reduces anxiety.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
so let's go through your 4 points there and see how it relates
let me say
to
something.
This.
Yeah, sure. So here's a person who suddenly feels obsessed with the idea of going to see dead corpses. Corpses, I don't want to be redundant. And then compulsively acts out the obsession by doing it. See, compulsion is behavior. Obsession is thinking. So he's thinking about it, that the obsession. And then he goes ahead and does it. That's the compulsion. And he does it every day until his wife notices that he's coming home late. So he talks about it to her, and then he confesses that he has this need to look at corpses. Now let's go through the 4 steps.
Through your 4 steps.
Yes.
So number one,
he has
is
a wish.
What is the wish?
Well, we don't know yet. I'll tell you in a few seconds. We don't know yet.
Okay, but there is a wish.
Oh,
there.
It has to be a wish.
But and don't it, we have to know the wish now, in order to find out who?
Well, here's what here's, in the
what
past.
The anger
in,
is?
Yeah, in the past, before we had this code, this formula, Schrinks never had a specific methodology to cure symptoms. It's never been done. Freud had a lot to say about symptoms, but it was scattered over a wide array of his publications. No one has formulated this kind of a code to penetrate and unravel the symptom, cure it. So what do I know about this guy right away? He has an obsessive notion about corpses, and he needs to see them compulsively. So what do I know about him automatically? I know that he's angry, that it's repressed. It's repressed towards someone, and that the actual symptom represents the wish. Freud said, no wish will be denied in the psyche. And this tells us how that's true.
Right. And that relates to the pleasure principle.
That relates to the pleasure principle, you see. So that when this guy goes to gaze at corpses, his wish, his original wish, is gratified in a disguised manner in the form of gazing at corpses. That's the disguised manner. But it represents the original wish. Now, what could the original wish
I'm
be?
I'm sitting at the edge of my seat, Henry.
Right. I'm glad to see that. Now, the original wish has got something to do with the fact that he's angry at someone. So let's round up the usual suspects. Is it his son? He has no son. His daughter? He has no daughter. Is it his wife? Possibly. It's a possible suspect. Who could it be? Is it a friend? So we have to ask him who his main people in life are. Who are our main people in life? Do we have more than 5? Do we have 4, 6? Not more than that. So if you round up the usual suspects, you will hit upon the right one. So turns out this guy's a doctor in the hospital. And his chief of service is a guy who didn't like him and gave him kind of menial tasks to do and gave the other doctors more important tasks. And he started to develop a hate towards this chief of service. So now it's obvious when I interpreted to him that every time he goes to gaze at corpses, it's his wish that the chief is one of the corpses each time. He wants that guy dead. And that's what that symptom is about.
And when you raised this to the surface, when you unraveled this?
It took exactly 2 sessions, and there was no more symptom.
And that was it?
That was it, 2 sessions.
Well, I can't argue with that.
That's right.
That is quite incredible.
Right. Because as soon as he realized...
Really astonishing.
As soon as he realized it was his chief that he was constantly wishing that would be, who would be dead, he was amazed.
That's incredible. Well, I'm talking to Dr. Henry Kellerman here on WBAI 99.5. FM, and we're talking about 4 steps to peace of mind. We're going to take a little break here, and in the spirit of Armand's positive mind show, Armand loves music, and he always has a little musical interlude. So I'm going to do that too, but I'm going to present it as a musical quiz. Okay, so I'm going to ask you to listen briefly to a short few bars of two different tunes, and I would like you to think about who the vocalist is here. You might think you know, but listen to this, and we'll solve the mystery when we come back.
First daffodils and long excited cables and candlelights on little corner tables. And still my heart has wings. These foolish things remind me of you.
Okay, now I'm sure many of you think you know exactly who that is. Let's just hear a little bit of this next tune to give you a clearer picture.
I can't give you anything but love, baby, that's the only thing I've plenty of, baby. Dream a while, scheme a while, you're sure to find happiness, and I guess all those things you've always pined for. Gee, I'd love to see you looking swell, baby. Diamond bracelets, Woolworths doesn't sell, baby. Till the very day, you know darn well.
Okay, we're back. I'm Dr. Bernard Starr, and again, this is The Positive Mind, and I'm sitting in for Armand DeMille today, and my guest is Dr. Henry Kellerman. And we just had a little musical quiz, and I suspect that many of you are saying, is he putting us on? Come on, that's an easy one. We know who that is. And I'm sure that many of you are saying, who? Do you know who it is, Henry?
Who was singing it?
Yeah, could you take a guess? No. Okay, but I'm sure a lot of people would say it's Nat King Cole.
No, it only sounds a bit like him.
Well,
it's definitely not him.
But if I didn't say that this is a quiz, you wouldn't pay that much attention to it, and you'd probably be pretty sure that that's Nat King Cole.
No, I knew it wasn't Nat King Cole. Okay.
But how many of you out there thought that was Nat King Cole? You'll be surprised, though, when I tell you who it is. It's somebody who has a lot in common with Nat King Cole. And the answer is, it's Oscar Peterson. And that was from an album. I think it may have been the only vocal album that he made. Because when Nat King Cole, who had, you're right, it's a little different. He has a much more sophisticated sound to and phrasing to his singing. But the voice quality is somewhat alike. And Oscar Peterson once said to Nat King Cole, he said, I'll never sing. He said, I'll never really record because there isn't enough room for two Nat King Coles. So Oscar Peterson just stuck to his piano playing that he was great at. So was Nat King Cole. He won the Downbeat Jazz Pianist Award many, many times. Interesting little musical interlude. Okay, now we're back to our topic. We were talking about your book and your four steps to peace of mind, and you outlined the various steps. But I want to leave that for the moment now and go to another subject, which is fascinating. And it's one that you have written about. It'll be out in a book soon. What is the title of that book that's coming out?
Which one are you talking about?
About the stereotyping.
Oh, it's called Greedy, Cowardly, and Weak, okay. Hollywood's Jewish Stereotypes.
Right, okay. So that's about stereotyping in films.
That's right.
Okay. And
in Hollywood films.
Right. And that is a very, au courant topic. We're all concerned with stereotyping. But, the fact is that everybody is stereotyped.
That's right.
You know, women, adolescents, old people, single women, blondes.
Ethnics.
Ethnic groups of and lawyers, Irish, Italians,
racial
Polish,
stereotyping.
Certainly African Americans. There's a whole history of incredible films in the early days of filmmaking that vicious stereotyped African-Americans. But, you know, some people say, well, with stereotypes, isn't there, an element of truth or fact in it? And they will say, you know, what essentially is the objection to stereotyping? Is the objection basically that it is unbalanced? For example, that you don't present everybody in that light, but that you show another side, whereas in some cases we only show one side. And surely that was the case with the stereotyping of African Americans. And by the way, it has a very interesting history, because one of the early people, I'm sure you're familiar with this, Henry, who was quite a star, an African-American star in the 1930s, and he developed this character called Step and Fetch It.
Right.
Okay, and, African-Americans, hated that characterization and that stereotype, and that was in the 1930s. Now, he made millions. He was really one of the early, maybe the only one of that period African-American movie stars. And he actually developed that character.
He wasn't African-American. In those days, he was Negro.
Well, Caribbean. His parents were from the Caribbean.
Yeah, but he still was Negro in those days.
Well, that's what he might have been called.
Right,
but,
right.
But he was, his parents were from the Caribbean. And he was quite an educated person, too. His actual name was Lincoln Theodore Monroe Andrew Perry. He was born in 1902, people believe. Was born in Key West, Florida. And he was actually a journalist, a newspaper man. He worked for the Chicago Defender, and he developed that character, which he described as the laziest man in the world. It was part of a vaudeville act, and it was one of the few African-American vaudeville acts that made its way to the white circuits. And he eventually got into films and made millions. So, you know, some people say, well, you know, but he was kind of groundbreaking, that he laid the foundation for African-Americans to get into films and
that's nonsense.
Et cetera. So,
that's nonsense, Bernie.
So I wonder how you think about that.
No, that's nonsense, Bernie, because as Robert J. Lifton, the great social psychiatrist, said, when you make certain people, less than human, you can do anything to them, including lynching them. That's a danger of stereotyping. And stereotyping, of course, is usually nonsense. It's false, even if it has a smidgen of some kind of characterization. It's not the whole person.
Well, and it also, along the lines of what you're saying, it really frames the way we think about people, that it definitely has an effect. So it's not just a funny kind of casual
That's
thing.
That's right, exactly.
In fact, there was a recent study by the National Opinion Poll that surveyed a cross-section of about 1,200 Americans, asking them, do people in these groups tend to be unintelligent or tend to be intelligent, asking about different ethnic groups? Do people in these groups tend to be hardworking or tend to be lazy? Do people in these groups tend to prefer to be self-supporting, or do they tend to prefer to live off welfare? And this is a current study. And with only one exception, minority groups were evaluated more negatively than whites in general. The one exception in this case were Jews, who were rated more favorably than whites on all characteristics except, interestingly, patriotism.
Right.
Okay. So despite what we've been told of all the advances that we've made in interracial relationships and our tolerance and our understanding of other cultures, here's a recent study that says that many of these stereotypes still exist, and many of them exist in films.
Right. As far as this patriotism business is concerned, a little notion about that, you know, that's probably because of the Rosenbergs. But the two greatest spies in American history were both Christian, one in the FBI, one in the CIA. Robert Hansen was one of them, both devout Christians. Okay, now what do you want to know about stereotypes, Bernie? In my book, you mean? My book?
Well, let's talk about two of the films that you that you target.
First, Hollywood has typically stereotyped Irish, Italians, blacks, Asians, Hispanics, and Jews. Irish are priests, soldiers, or cops. Italians are mafiosa or gangsters. Blacks were slow-witted and not to be trusted. Hispanics were lowlifes. Asians were inscrutable and sly, and you can never know what's going on with their motives. And Jews were greedy, cowardly, and weak. And in this book, I focus on Jews, on the stereotypes about Jews. Now, let's take the most egregious example of them all, and that's the 1931 release of Dracula, starring Bela Lugosi.
Yeah, actually, Lon Chaney was supposed to have that part, but he got ill, and that's how Bela Lugosi got the part.
Right. Now, Bela Lugosi is a vampire, a bloodsucker. And what pendant does he wear on his on his tuxedo shirt? What pendant do you think he wears?
What is that?
He wears a pendant, like a necklace, on his shirt. Guess what it is?
What?
Star of David. Star of David.
In that 1931.
I invite all listeners to look at this movie, the 1931 release, The Star of David on his pendant. Now, what is the only thing that can kill Dracula?
The cross. Right.
So it's the cross is good and the Star of David is evil, you see. And the evil one is wearing a Jewish star, so he's Jewish, and he's a bloodsucker. Now, what's the symbol of bloodsucking? Money. Draining one's blood is draining one's money. The blood of society is the mud. So there's the stereotype right there. And it's horrendous. Now, the interesting thing about that movie, or one of the interesting things, is that that movie was filmed during the day. A Spanish film crew from Spain filmed the exact movie in the evening using the exact same sets with the same script in Spanish, with the same dialogue. Everything was the same. All the accoutrements of the set were the same. There was only one thing that was different in the evening Spanish version. What was that?
You tell us, Henry. What?
Dracula was not wearing a Star of David. So there was somebody in the evening Spanish version who understood that whole thing and did something about it.
You know, it's curious, though, in preparation for this interview with you, and I knew you were going to talk about Dracula, I Googled Dracula and drew and Googled a lot of reviews of it because there were a lot of negative reviews of it. In fact, it was banned in some countries, actually. And that same director who directed it produced a film, a notorious film that was called Freaks.
Yes, that's a terrible film.
That was banned in England for 30 years. Yeah. That was a very I think it dealt with people with all kinds of disorders.
That's
who were
right.
circus performers.
That's
and,
right.
In
yeah.
Coney Island,
mm-hmm.
I think,
yeah.
A lot of them. But it's interesting, with respect to Dracula, I didn't hear or read any negative criticism along these lines, that apparently few people had picked
noticed
up that aspect of it, whereas in other films that you discuss, it's much more
blatant. You see, in each of the chapters, I discussed 20 films in this book, Greedy, Cowardly, and Weak, Hollywood's Jewish Stereotypes. 10 of the films I call hardcore egregious, and 10 of the films are more benign. But each chapter of each, representing each film in the book, has a section called Hidden in Plain Sight. So despite the fact that people, millions of people have seen this film Dracula with Bela Lugosi, and the Jewish star is hanging there on his neck in full view against his white shirt, No one seems to notice it.
Well, you know, there's an old joke about too, where using that symbol of Dracula wearing the Jewish star, where Dracula, you know, approaches this person after midnight and is about to suck the blood out, and the person wakens and holds up the cross to thwart Dracula, and Dracula, it says in Yiddish, won't help you, and
right.
it turns out he's wearing the Star of David,
right.
so the cross isn't going to help you.
Right.
So that has been satirized, but there are other films in which it's much clearer to the general viewing audience that the theme is stereotypic.
Well, Enemy at the Gates is a story about Russian Nazi war in Russia, where a Russian sniper is plying his trade against a Nazi sniper and vice versa.
Right. It was a Russian political officer who transforms this unknown soldier, Vasily Zaitsev, who's played by Jude Law, into a media hero and the human face of the Russian army's battle against the Nazis. He notched more than 140 kills, and news of his exploits boost morale in the dwindling Russian ranks. And then the Germans bring in one of their sharpshooters to face off
with him. That's played by Ed Harris. The thing that rankled me originally when I first saw it is that Vasily, this hero, non-Jew, and Danilov, the Jewish propaganda minister, meet on the battlefield. And Danilov, the Jewish guy, can't shoot a rifle. But the Gentile peasant, played by Jude Law, is a sharpshooter. No one can shoot better than him. And he's the hero. Now, they both fall in love with one of the Russian partisans who happens to be a Jewish girl. Now, who does she respond to? Who does she fall in love with? The Jewish guy who can't shoot a rifle, or the hero who's not Jewish? I'll give you one guess. Okay, you got it right. So
the clock is ticking.
Right. So you see, the Jewish guy, the propaganda minister, gets so angry at that he begins to undermine the hero, and he begins to spread false rumors about him. So he's a lowlife. The Jew turns out to be, you know, not a stand-up guy. He turns out to be someone who can't be trusted, cowardly, weak, no integrity. And so at the end of the movie, in order to redeem the situation, he stands in front of a bullet coming towards the hero, takes the bullet, and dies. So this is supposed to be a redemption moment. But what's the true message? The true message is, any good Jew is a dead Jew. That is the message of that ending. Any good Jew is a dead Jew. And in the DVD... narrative on the DVD indicates that these two guys, the Nazi sniper and the hero, Vasily, are courageous, upstanding, and with great integrity and courage and macho stuff, you know.
But do you feel that message very clearly impacts the viewing audience, that they come away with a strong feeling about that? Because there are other images that say something else.
It's not direct. It's subliminal. The message is subliminal, and it corresponds. It's tuned in the same key as the rest of stereotypes about Jews. It's like the best, but any good Indian is a dead Indian. That's the message. If there's any good Jews, a dead Jew.
But on the other hand, you do have stereotypes of, in the case of Jews, as lawyers and doctors and accountants,
right.
And often that takes a nasty turn the greed of money. But, you know, if you look back historically, a lot of the stereotypes grew out. They were kind of self-fulfilling prophecies. For example, throughout Europe up until the Industrial Revolution, Jews couldn't work in Europe.
Right. We know there are reasons for it.
Yeah. So they developed the whole area of finance and became bankers and et cetera, because they couldn't work in some respects. And then they took on some of these stereotypic portraits of them. In the, another example of that is with African Americans during the period of slavery. We know that African Americans could not learn how to read or write. They were legally prevented from doing it. It was considered illegal. And then when it was discovered they couldn't read and write, they said, well, look how ignorant these people are. They can't read or write.
Exactly.
So some of these things are the legacy of social trends that happened historically.
People also remember negative things about ethnic characterizations. They don't remember positive.
But that's why I'm asking the question about balance. In other words, if we were to address this at face value, we would come to the conclusion from the examples that you're giving, and we could come up with a host of them, of these negative stereotypes of almost every ethnic
group.
Is the answer then that we should eliminate stereotyping completely? Would that affect the homogenization of
everybody? No, it's not about homogenization.
Let me just add one other thing. Is the answer what I had suggested earlier, balance? That it's not just the stereotyping per se, but that it becomes objectionable when it's unbalanced. For example, for a long time, African Americans were portrayed only in the light of the character that Stepan Fetcher created. If it were balanced, perhaps the objections that would still be there, but not as strong. But it becomes really nasty when that's the only picture that you keep getting over and over again.
I don't think it's a question of balance. I think it's a question of simply giving people parts to play that that reflect human experience, the realistic human experience. And it's not a matter of trying to bias people. Take Jews, for example. You mentioned greed, and I have greed in the title. Now, we know that at the very top of most professional fields, you have a lot of Jews. At the very top. So that, let's say, the scientists are trying to discover a cure for polio. Now, we could predict that because there's so many great Jewish scientists around that it might be a very likely chance that a Jewish scientist could discover it. We can't be sure, but it turned out it was. Take Bernie Madoff. If something bad is going to happen at the top of any field, there are many Jews at the top of any field, it's possible, probable, that it could be a Jewish person doing something bad, like Bernie Madoff. We can't predict it, but in this case it was. But people remember the Bernie Madoff greed, and they tend to disregard or accept at face value without giving it much credence the Jonas Salk situation.
Yes. Well, if you have hatred in your heart, you could spin things in any direction. Take the attitude of the Nazi Germany toward Jews, where they tried to characterize Jews as inferior. But the fact was that a third of all the Nobel Prizes in Germany, even though the Jews represented a very minuscule part of their population, that a third of all the Nobel Prizes prior to the Nazi era were won by Jews, and yet it didn't stop them from looking at Jews as being inferior.
Well, that one-third figure is also a kind of funny figure, because many Jewish scientists who didn't get the Nobel Prize didn't get it because they were Jewish, and despite that, you had one-third getting it.
Right, so there may have even been more, but I'm saying that did not stop them from their negative characterization of Jews. You know, here's another issue that I'm fascinated by with the stereotyping, and as I read some of your material and some of these reviews, it really jumped out at me. And that is, I wonder how the actors in these films felt about playing these roles. Let's say if you're a Jew and you're playing a stereotypic role of a Jew or an Irish person or an African-American. Well, I would have liked to ask the man who created the Stepan Fetcher character of how he felt, how he felt about characterizing blacks in the way that he did. Mm. Now, he made a fortune out of it, and he may have paved the way, for others.
No, he didn't pave the way for anybody.
Well, that may be true. Up until very recently, we know that African Americans were underrepresented in the media in every respect, in advertising, in whatnot. In fact, a good friend of mine, Ronnie Romano, who was the head of Ted Bates for a number of years, he's the one who invented and shot the O.J. Simpson ad before O.J. Simpson got into trouble.
Stereotypes always have a negative implication. Even with African American athletes, they're great. The stereotype is, however, that the African American athlete is always going to be great. That's because he's not too smart. He's not intellectual. He's just physical. That's a stereotype. Stereotypes always have a negative implication.
Well, but I'll tell you, in the case of the O.J. ad, and by the way, when Ronnie Romano pitched this to Hertz, they were not, wouldn't even repeat what they said here initially, and Ronnie's a very cool character, and he said, and you have to remember, he was really a national hero at that time, before the whole murder trial and his current difficulties, and he convinced them. He said, look, he's really a national hero, and he was very loved by everybody. So they said yes, and it became the most popular ad in the history of advertising, and that was a breakthrough for African Americans in advertising. The success of that Hertz ad with O.J. Simpson.
Yeah, right.
So sometimes, that does work. Well, unfortunately, our time here is winding down.
You.
And I want to thank you, Henry, for coming on the show today and taking this abuse from me today. And the best of luck with your new book. You can Google Dr. Henry Kellerman. You'll find links to all of his books. And thanks to Armand for creating this great show and inviting me on. And Armand will be back tomorrow, so tune in. In fact, lock in your radio to 99.5 FM, WBAI. And remember, follow the Positive Mind Rulebook. Think positive, and be happy. And to help you along, here's the formula in song.
You've got to start off each day with a song. Now, even when things go wrong, you feel better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you'll be a go-getter. Now, the way that you shake my hand will tell me how I stand. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now, you know that you can't go wrong. If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day with a song.
Oh, sing it, Jimmy boy.
Even when things go wrong,
sing it for the hoi polloi.
You feel better, you even look better. Ah, that music, it does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Last night I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go, you have to push it. I got a million of them, a million of them.
Yes, you certainly do, Jimmy Durante. And no, it's not 8:30 on a Saturday morning. That's actually the theme song to Any Saturday with David Rothenberg. That'll be taking place this Saturday at 8:30 a.m. And just amazing. Thank you so much to Bernie Starr and Drs. Bernie Starr and Henry Kellerman. And just check this out, and that just points to the flexibility of WBAI.